Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for Driving Me Crazy, coming to you live from Beechtree Studios near beautiful Pinehurst, North Carolina. This is the only show where a husband and wife drive, talk cars and life, and still love one another each day. Here's John and Laurie. Or is it Laurie and John? Oh, take it away, you crazy kids.
Cars and life. Cars and life.
Good morning, Hezzy. Good morning, listeners.
Good morning.
Good morning, Johnny.
What comes first, sweetheart? Life or cars? What comes first?
Well, tell
life,
us.
Life, actually.
And what an exciting week you've had, Hezzy. We're so happy to
Speaking
hear
of life.
Well, yeah. So we're so happy to hear that you're feeling fine.
Yeah,
really fantastic. Today's like the best day I've had medically. So
that's
really
cool.
Good.
Yeah, really
that's
good.
That's just wonderful. Johnny had actually a bit of a spell himself. He suddenly became very swollen in his abdomen, and he was experiencing a lot of pain.
and discovered that I'm, what is it?
Hypoglycemic.
No.
Oh, no.
Lactose intolerant. Which is something that
really?
suddenly came on me. And the doctor said, oh, this happens all the time. I'm like,
I
wish somebody
that.
Had told me.
I didn't know that
I didn't either.
All the time.
It took a little while
to
get him
goodness.
Rewired, but yeah, he was fine after that.
Yeah, it was not a pleasant
thank God
time.
For that.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to talk about the wonderful 2022 Chrysler Pacifica Hybrid Limited, which, of course, is one of my very favorite all-time vehicles. This was increasingly step above. Every new model year, there's something new and different. But before we do, as you know, Hezzy, and as our regular listeners know, dealing with the car industry has been a bit of a challenge, not just for us,
Absolutely. But
for anybody who's been
for
in the
car industry.
For the car industry.
Yes.
And it's been one thing or another with the microchips and then with production. Yeah.
Supply lines.
And then the economy, of course, now is in an iron lung, and that doesn't help either because car dealers have a real dilemma for them. They can't get delivery of cars. They can't find opportunities to, they cannot find opportunities to even get used cars. And so it's been really quite something for them and then for us. And with us, it was a difficulty getting press cars. And so.
Yeah.
Lori bought a car.
And so I bought a Cadillac. Johnny, tell our listeners what happened.
Well, you know, we've been having a lot of trouble getting vehicles to review, and it's not the fault of the people who send us cars. They can't get the cars either, and the car manufacturers have so few cars. I mean, the logic of it is simple. If you don't have cars to sell, there's no use taking cars out of the fleet you could sell to give to people to review, to get people to want to buy them who can't buy them because there aren't any. So we have my car, which is a wonderful vehicle, plan to keep it forever, but we needed a second vehicle, a newer one that we could take on a trip if we needed to go somewhere, that kind of thing. And so, as you know, we've had very good relationship with Clark Chevrolet Cadillac here in Pinehurst.
Absolutely.
Been around forever.
They're fantastic.
And so Lori called, and they had a 2016 Cadillac SX5, which is kind of like the sports car, or sports SUV, the SUV. And it had 60,000 miles on it. So we went over and looked at it. It was beautiful, well-maintained. I mean, that's 6 years, about 10,000 miles a year, so it certainly hadn't been driven to the ground. Great. They had serviced it, taken care of it. It's beautiful. All the bells and whistles. And so Lori bought it. So that we knew that we had a second vehicle, which in today's world, if you're a family, you probably need two vehicles. You can get by with one. But for right. us, for example, if I'm going somewhere and Lori needs to go somewhere, and or we're going together and we're going to, for example, see her brother in Virginia, and that's a 4-hour drive each way. You just mm-hmm. sort of want that feeling that you are going to go there and back and not be concerned about breaking down or anything. I don't think my old car would break down, but it's just a peace of mind thing in knowing that if you have to have something done to one, you can put it in the shop, and then you have another that you can use
right.
while one's being worked on. It's just, you know, those kinds of things. But anyway, it was is lovely, and it was lovely to work with the Cadillac people, and they did a beautiful job for helping her purchase the vehicle. And, you know, as you say, thank God we had the money to buy the vehicle, so it was pretty seamless kind of a thing, and we're very happy with our purchase. So, go, Lori.
Drive it in good health.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, for 33 years I've been doing car reviews, and although in the past I've owned my own car, mm-hmm. we only have had one car to share, Johnny and I, over the past 11 years of our marriage, simply because we haven't needed a second car, you know, getting
yeah.
a car a week anyway as a review car. But with the difficulty in press fleets and now manufacturing, we would have these, as Johnny explained, these huge wads of time when we really had to juggle things. Plus, the press car mandates are now restricted, so we can only go a certain amount of miles a week. And if we wanted
mm-hmm.
to take a road trip, we had to get special dispensation, like from the Pope. So,
or rent a car.
Or rent a car, which we've done. So this has been really delightful, and it's lovely to, you know, get into a Cadillac. And so that's been, and, you know, as the press fleets get back, you know, on board, which they will shortly for the 2023 year, then, you know, we'll be okay.
Well, that was a question.
Maybe.
Do you think that they will?
Yeah, I do. They have to. I mean, at least the press fleets do. But the interesting thing with the dealerships is they can't get enough inventory on new cars, and they can't get enough inventory
yeah.
inventory on used cars, because when somebody wants to trade in a used car and there's no inventory for a new car, and then what are they going to get? And if they want to get another new car, it's like a vicious cycle. These are very strange times in the world on many levels right now.
Well, and it's interesting,
mm-hmm.
too, because I talking about used cars and new cars, and I called a fellow that I deal with at one of the Ford dealerships, who's actually where I got my Ford Edge, and the guy that I worked with, and think a great deal of him, and I asked him about, you know, what my vehicle might be worth and trading it in or getting a new vehicle, and he said,
mm-hmm.
"Well, I've got a Ford. What's the one below? Bigger than a Bronco, smaller than the big one." Hezzy, I can't. I'm going blank here.
I can't remember
it
now. Story. It doesn't matter the model.
Yeah, it's an SUV, and he said I've got
okay.
this one in, and he said the people traded it in. It's only got 30,000 miles on it, but they wanted
yeah.
a smaller one that got better mileage. And I thought,
okay.
what do you think about this? And, you know, and I've always said gas is the least expensive part of owning a car. Now, that's the truth.
Right.
A set of tires cost, you know, 10 years worth of gas. But that's what people notice. And so you've got people who are trading in bigger vehicles now to get smaller vehicles that are more fuel efficient, which I thought
mm-hmm.
that was an interesting turn. So there's a lot going on, I think, in the automotive industry. And I also think that there's 330 million people in this country, and of the 330 million who are looking to buy cars, I would be willing to bet you a lot of them have the same ideas, which we talk about. You know, what are you looking for? They're looking for value. They're looking to save money on gas. These are obvious things: value, money on gas, comfort, looks. Don't think that looks don't play into it, because they do. And function. So I think everybody has the same criteria when they're looking for cars. If you have five kids, you're looking at a Chrysler Pacifica.
So let's look at
the
Chrysler Pacifica. How about it?
That was a segue to lead you right into
that.
That
was brilliant, honey.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. So we love this guy. I love this guy. I absolutely love the Pacifica in any way, shape, form, or color. It's just such a clever, such a beautifully constructed driving family car. Actually, when I bought the Cadillac SUV, they had a Chrysler Pacifica that had just come in on a trade, and I was very sorely tempted. But then again, Johnny reminded me that for our local needs and for our long-distance needs, we generally aren't hauling 12 grandchildren with us all the time. So,
forever.
although we did when we took them up to Maine in March, we rented a Chrysler Pacifica. It was brilliant, but we had to use two cars. In any event, this is one of the great reasons why this is such a fantastic car is because this hybrid will get 82 miles per gallon on fuel economy, electric and gasoline, and a staggering and a staggering 30 miles a gallon just on gas. That's pretty huge. That really is. And so with fuel economy and the what they call the greenhouse gas rating, it gets a full 10 out of 10. And again,
when you talk about hybrids and reducing emissions and but not being stranded when your vehicle runs out of electric power.
Exactly.
This hybrid concept, I think they need to spend a little more time perfecting the hybrid concept before they try to do this transitioning to electric, which, and I don't mean to get political here, but every country that's tried this has gone under because of the economies are based on fossil fuels. You can't get away from it. And I'm very concerned that this is a very short-sighted approach. But the hybrid approach is a nice compromise in those two worlds.
Now, on this vehicle, the manufacturer's base price is $54,000. We, of course, had a fully loaded model at $59,000 and change. It had it all, including
and a lot more.
Yeah. So we were pretty excited about that. But the beautiful thing about this vehicle is even with the optional equipment, the equipment options are basically, extra trim. It's a trim package, a pro exterior paint, coat. And then the Uconnect Theater Family Group, which has the televisions on the back of the front seat so that rows 2 and 3 can look and watch that. If you've got kids or grandkids, for $2,395, I say you better get it because it'll keep your blood pressure low. But the
Are we there yet?
But the other thing, and perhaps the most important thing of all, is this has got all the bells and whistles for safety. And, in fact, it has a 5-star for overall vehicle safety. It's amazing. And I can go through the list, but you know that list. It's becoming so standard with almost every car, the 360-degree surround view camera system, the park sense, front and rear parking assist, parallel and perpendicular park assist, and on and on and on. So when you have a very...
Driver's alerts, things that did never, it's just driver's alert, stopping you, forward collision alert, and stopping you, keeping you from backing out into, it never ceases to amaze me. And this is a simple thing. It's not a safety thing, but it's a simple thing. Do you remember the old Pacificas and any of the big vans, and you would open the door and then slide it back, and then you would have to slide it up, and sometimes it wouldn't shut, and you'd open it up again and slam it shut again and push on the back to get it. And, they've really taken all of that into consideration so that now not only does the trunk open and close with the push of a button, but used to in the old ones, there was only one side that had a door. Do you remember that? I do.
I remember.
And so now they have doors on both sides, and it's push button. You push the button, it opens. You push the button, you don't have to do anything. You just push the button, and it closes, and it locks itself. And it's just – I mean, the technology that they put into something this size and for what it's intended to do is really, really, really good.
Now, this vehicle is pretty much built on a small truck base chassis, so you know you've got that to think about, especially with these safety features and with the driver alerts. And that's because it's longer than most cars. It's the length of most small trucks, and also because you've got seven people in the car. Three rows, that's going to block you, although the windows, side windows, are very open and airy when you, as we tend to do, older drivers, look over our right shoulder to see if anything's oncoming, because that's how we were taught.
Not in the ones with a bad neck.
Yeah, that's how we, well, you, yeah, but that's how we were taught in driver safety 6 or 7 millennium ago. And so, but it's a very clear view, even despite the fact that you've got, passengers. Now, the second row are pretty much captain's chairs. They are individual chairs, two chairs. Third row, you could fit three kids easy. But the nice thing is, because when you get in, and the automatic sliding doors make this easy to open and easy to close, it's just by the pull of the latch. But when somebody, if let's say an adult wants to get into the third row, or two adults, which it certainly can mm-hmm. accommodate, then you're walking between the two bucket seats, between the two, theoretically, captain's chairs, and you've got an aisle. And it's easy, and because this vehicle is tall, you're not doing gymnastics or gyrations to get back there. So really, it's a very well planned, accommodating interior. And the thing, of course, that I love the most about the Pacifica is that when you want to have open interior space for carrying whatever, dog crates or luggage or whatever, you can mm-hmm. collapse all the second and third row, and it goes into the floor.
Yeah.
Interior storage capacity is second to none on any minivan with this vehicle.
Yeah, I put a note in there. I think there's like 32 cubic feet with the seats up. But when you put them down, this is incredible. When you put them down, you have 140.5 cubic feet of space. 140 feet of space behind the front seat.
Wow.
And the thing, and Lori's talking about all the things she loved. Here's the thing I loved. Chrysler did not skimp on the engine. How many of these vehicles do you see that use a four-cylinder and a turbo and then you load it up and it's
mostly.
Like, yeah, it struggles. The Chrysler Pacifica has a 3.6-liter V6, a six-cylinder mm-hmm. with 260 horsepower. And front-wheel drive.
Responsive instantly.
Yeah, it was really a pleasure to drive. You felt very good about pulling out into traffic, knowing what your vehicle would do, no delay. Oh, it was just, that six-cylinder makes a big difference in a vehicle like that.
No shimmying, no sense whatsoever at any time that you do not have full control of this vehicle. Now, one of the things that makes this more than just the TV sets on the back of the first row headrests is the fact that it's almost really, truly, if you're on a long trip, with or without kids or dogs or whatever, there's so many, we used to call them luxuries, but we've become so used to wonderful speaker and sound systems. This has a 20-speaker Harman Kardon radio system, absolutely beautiful. The Apple CarPlay, everything that we now see everywhere. Apple CarPlay, Google Android Auto, the Uconnect with five navigator. The Uconnect with a 10.1-inch touchscreen display, big touchscreen display. Rajani heated steering wheels, front heated and air conditioned seats. On and on. So it's just accommodating. It's luxury for a family without feeling like you're spending a lot of money, because truly for $59,000 fully loaded, this is a heck of a deal.
Well, and the other thing, if you don't want a hybrid, let's just say you wanted the gas version, because they certainly make the gas version of the Pacifica.
Yeah.
Gas version starts at $37,000. The hybrid starts at $46,000. So you're talking about almost $10,000 more, actually about right at $10,000 more for a hybrid. But you can buy the gas Pacifica for $37,000, which is really a lot of vehicle for that kind of money, I think. That was one thing. The other thing is the hybrid, of course, you can it'll do some charging when you're driving with the brakes, you know, how you hit the brakes and it charges the battery. But you can also plug it in, and it takes like 14 hours for it to go from 0 to 100% charge. And it only gets, that only increases or makes the electric range 32 miles on electric. Well, that's not very much, and it's really not very much. But the key thing about what Chrysler has done is use the computer system to constantly monitor when it should be in gas and when it can use electric. So that's how you up with that. That's how you wind up with that 82 miles to the gallon, because it's constantly looking like if you're going on level, let's say, and you're maintaining speed or whatever, it would immediately go to like electric, at least for a certain period of time, and it was smooth and seamless, and then it would go to gas because it's trying to make sure that you're getting the benefit of both systems the best that you can. I think that's really good. Again, this is really good technology that people don't pay enough attention to, in my opinion, don't pay enough attention to, in what you can achieve with these types of hybrid models. So I hope that helps.
Well, isn't that indicative of people like you and Lori who actually divulge this sort of thing? Because I don't think it's well known. It's not the sort of subject that one keeps up on, and you may not recognize that technology is already there.
Because people
are ignorant. They remember what happened 5 years ago.
Well, I think...
And they think it's the same.
Well, I think that certainly is true. And I also think, and I remember this from a number of things that I've done, including teaching school and also being in the outdoor business, but from a sales standpoint, people know things, and we assume that the people we are talking to know what we know. If you understand what I'm saying.
I do understand. Yep.
Yeah. If I were to sit down and talk to you about going to Argentina or going to Canada or going to Texas and going on these shooting things or whatever, I would assume, which is always a mistake, that you would have some basic knowledge of what I'm talking about. And I think it's the same with salespeople.
But in that case, I do.
but I think when it comes to vehicles and selling, there's so many choices and that kind of thing that the salesman knows an awful lot, and he assumes that if I were to come in and I'd ask him, do you have any Pacifica hybrids, for example, he would assume that I've already gained some knowledge of the hybrids, and he's not going to spend a lot of time trying to sell me on the concept because he assumes I understand the concept, whereas I only may know that the hybrid gets better gas mileage and not know why. So I would if I'm a consumer, and if anyone is a consumer, you need to ask the questions, make a list of questions you want answered when you go in to look at a new vehicle, not just the mileage and not just the, how long. You need to know what's the life expectancy on these brand new tires. Are they 40,000-mile tires, 60,000-mile tires, 100,000-mile tires? Or have they had any recalls in previous models? What updates have been done this last year? You want to know everything, because spending $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 is a significant investment in something that you are going to keep hopefully at least 5 years and maybe longer, depending on whether you like it or not. So anyway, and you're right. The reason that we ask and talk about these kinds of things is because we discover them. Remember, we have these cars for a week, and I've told you before, but when they leave, it's like, I'm sure I didn't find out everything I was supposed to have found out about the car. You don't have time.
Mm-hmm.
And you can read the manual, but reading the manual, driving the car, and figuring out how all these things work together takes time.
But I wouldn't classify this vehicle as something you need to take a college course.
Oh, absolutely not.
Figure it out. Everything's, exactly where you expect it to be. But
my point being that, like, if you have the televisions and all those, you have to learn how those things work in relationship to when you're driving and how you control the air conditioning in the front and the back. And, you know, there's things that you continue to learn as you drive the car until it becomes second nature to you.
Yeah.
Good response. Go, babe. That's it. That's what.
I think you're right.
That's what I was looking for. Validation. You go, girl.
Now, but here I'm going to say this a zillion times from both of us. This is where I stop. This is where I don't go beyond. Because I'm going to tell you here now, this car is so brilliant in the fact that it's electric and gas. But I will not take a car that's purely electric. Not yet.
No. Me either.
You know, we're going to hype this Pacifica and any hybrid that gives you the potential to get this kind of mileage if you keep it, you know, charged. But until we have charging stations, fast charging stations, not these charging stations that take 8 hours, until we have
exactly.
a network of charging stations conveniently placed, you know, even across Death Valley, then the electric car is just not practical.
And the upgrades to the grid to make sure that everybody's not draining the thing at the same time, along with all the other electrical uses that are required. I'm telling you, there's a lot of short-sightedness in the automotive industry. Well, now, I will take that back. I apologize to the automotive industry. It is not in the automotive industry. They are only responding to the demands of the current, of any administration who put all these requirements. On them. And I think that that's very short-sighted. That's another story.
But okay, so we've got on one end the purely electric car, which just expressed our lack of support for. And on the other hand, you've got the purely gas car. Okay, that's what we're used to. That's what's going to stay, you know, for a long, long time, despite what anybody says. But then you've got something like this Chrysler Pacifica Hybrid, which is electric and gas, and if you've got a quick recharging system, then you can get that 82 miles a gallon, you know, depending on if you're driving flat or whatever mountainous. But the fact of the matter is, that's the happy medium. And to me, that's where the car industry needs to go. Gas and electric, knowing that we do not have the infrastructure to support fully electric cars in this country at this time, next year. Probably not in the 5 years upcoming, but who knows? So, but if
really I'm going to ask you one question, even though it's not about this particular item, but are there some manufacturers that are starting to manufacture more vehicles? Do they have access to the chips that we may not have access to, or is there a resurgence in the industry?
There are so
some
many
companies seems like they're doing a better job in getting the technological components, and others are not.
There are so many other mitigating.
It surprises me.
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
There are so many other mitigating factors that we're not aware of, such as the vastly increased shipping charges of cars and parts from foreign countries, the taxes on things, the lack of a labor force in the way we used to have. Now they're saying that there's an increase in employment, which is directly contrary to the amount that's being produced. In other words, employment can rise, but production seems to be decreasing. So there are so many factors. I don't know. I do know that from the standpoint of the dealers, especially just going through what we did with Clark, wonderful Cadillac, here in Pinehurst, North Carolina, that they cannot get inventory. So is that going to change? And listen, Clark's been around forever. They always have had inventory. They've always been able to deliver. They're waiting now 6, 8, 10, 12 weeks longer just to get delivery of a special order.
Wow.
I do not know, and I wouldn't even project, but right now, if you need a car, just realize that you may be paying much more than you anticipated. Some cars have extra expenses, $1,200, $1,500, $2,000 added because of increase in shipping charges to a new car, and the lack of, or even the used cars, they are far more expensive than ever they were. So it's cars are not a buyer's market. Now real estate's becoming a buyer's market, but I don't know, Jesse, I really don't. And on that happy note, our time's up.
What a pleasure. Thank you so much, guys.
Now, next week, you'll just have me, Hezzy, because Johnny's off traveling. So it'll just be you and me,
okay.
Hezzy. All right.
I love it.
Hey, hey.
I don't get that opportunity every week.
Yeah.
Have a great trip, John.
Thank you, my friend. Looking forward to talking to you soon.
Talk to you next week, Hezzy. Everybody stay safe. Stay cool.
Take care. Thank you, Lori. Thank you, John. Oh, always a pleasure. Be well.
You too.
Have a safe trip, too, John. Thank you. Well, there we have it. None other than the Driving Me Crazy duo, John and Lori Wiles. And I hope you enjoyed this review of the 2022 Chrysler Pacifica Hybrid Limited S appearance model. Always very, very exciting. Well, we've got a couple of things that we want to cover. So we're going to cover some other issues. Hopefully you'll find interesting. Bear with me a moment here. You know, there was a lot of talk, for example, about the Taliban, and they made promises. The question is, have they kept their promises? So a year ago, the Taliban retook Kabul. In their first press conference after seizing power in Afghanistan, they surprised the world with the announcement of moderate policy. The key pledge was to address women's rights. Women's rights will be respected within the norms of Islamic law, they wrote. The claim is that the group's spokesman, Zabihullah Mujahid, said in his first press conference in August of 2021, quote, "Women are going to be very active in the society, but within the framework of Islam. And within those frameworks, they would be allowed to work and study." So when we check the facts, it seems that it's false. So when the Taliban took power, many feared a regime as harsh on women as under the group's last rule in the 1990s. 1 year on, the Taliban have implemented many restrictions on women's lives. Women must cover themselves from head to toe in public. If a woman doesn't cover her face outside the home, her father or closest male relative could be imprisoned or fired from government jobs. Women can't board planes without a male guardian, who has to be her husband or a close male relative past puberty. Entry to public parks in Afghanistan is limited by gender. 3 days are reserved for women, 4 for men. However, according to a decree, it is strongly recommended that women leave home only when necessary. Taliban quote safety concerns for making such decisions, but scholars say that these kinds of restrictions are not covered by Islamic law. Syed Abdul Hadi Hidayat, an Afghanistan-based religious scholar, is opposed to the Taliban's way of imposing rules on Afghan women to cover their bodies. Quote, "There is a consensus among Muslim clerics in country on the hijab itself, but there are different opinions about the type of hijab for women." Adding, he told, that according to Islam's faith, hands and feet are not part of the areas that should be covered. Isn't this fascinating when you come to think of it? The Taliban have also restricted access to work in certain sectors as outlined in a report by Amnesty International. Most female government employees have been told to stay at home, with the exception of those working in certain sectors such as health and education, the report said. Well, the Taliban policy appears to be that they will only allow women
who cannot be replaced by men to keep working. And many women in high-level positions, even in the private sector, have been dismissed. This policy also contravenes basic Islamic understanding. Islam treated women equally, particularly in the field of education, said Farid Yunus, a retired professor of Middle Eastern Studies and Islamic Philosophy at California State University in East Bay. Yunus said that women have played a major role in education and history and cites the example of the Prophet Muhammad's wife and daughter. Both Hidayat and Yunus said that according to Islamic teaching, education is mandatory for both men and women. Quote, Islamic Sharia is not against the education and working of women because we won't have a functioning and prosperous society without the role of women, said Hidayat. This is also logical, but we've been, I guess, proselytized to the point of believing this BS. Women who have protested against the Taliban's restrictions and policies have been harassed, threatened, arrested, and even tortured, said Amnesty International. Well, girls will be able to attend high school was the claim. Well, while younger girls were able to resume education in segregated classes a few weeks after the Taliban seized power, female students in secondary schools have not been able to go back. On September 21st, Taliban spokesperson Mujahid said that the Ministry of Education is working hard to provide the ground for the education of high school girls as soon as possible, yet no frame was mentioned. In March, the Education Ministry announced that classes would open for all students, including girls. However, one day later, as girls attended school for the first time, the ministry reversed the order, calling for female students to leave school. The ministry blamed a lack of teachers and school uniform issues and claimed it would open schools up to girls once a plan was drawn up in accordance with Islamic law and Afghan culture. And since then, nothing has changed. Well, let's look at the general amnesty for former enemies. It seems the claim was on August 17 of 2021, when the Mujahid had said, quote, I would like to assure all the compatriots, whether they were translators, whether they were with military activities, or whether they were civilians, all of them have been important. Nobody's going to be treated with revenge. And yet thousands of soldiers who have fought us for 20 years after the occupation, all of them have been pardoned. Well, let's look at the falsehood of that. After an initial wave of reprisal killings unleashed during the Taliban takeover, and Amnesty International puts it, and a door-to-door manhunt was alleged by collaborators in the days surrounding the Taliban seizure of power in Kabul, it appears that Islamists have not carried out the feared sweeping revenge campaign against their former enemies. However, the United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan, UNAMA, UNAMA, has recorded at least 160 extrajudicial killings, 178 arbitrary arrests, 23 incommunicado arrests, and 56 cases of torture of former government and security officials committed by the Taliban authorities between August 15 of 2021 and June 15 of 2022. The UNAMA report on human rights in Afghanistan concludes that the amnesty was violated on several occasions. God, what can I tell you? It just doesn't end. Now, these figures do not include dozens of extrajudicial killings, ill treatment, and arbitrary arrests of alleged members of the Islamic State,
Khorasan province and the National Resistance Front of Afghanistan, NRF. Well, the NRF defended the Panjshir Valley from Taliban forces until September of last year and is still attempting to wrestle back control of the region. In June, Amnesty International reported, quote, the use of torture, extrajudicial executions, and arbitrary arrests of civilians accused of being NRF or National Resistance Front of Afghanistan members by the Taliban in Panjshir province. Zaman Sultani, a South Asia researcher with Amnesty, describes this practice as a growing pattern. Well, there's no threat or reprisal will be carried out against journalists. That was the claim by the Taliban spokesmen, who have reiterated this promise given to Reporters Without Borders, RSF, claiming their commitment to impartial media and free press freedom, as long as they do not interfere with the Taliban's cultural framework. Well, let's look at the facts. There's a falsehood here. Only days after taking power in Kabul, Taliban fighters killed a relative of a Deutsche Welle journalist they were hunting. In September of 2021, the International Federation of Journalists reported that Fahim Dashti, the head of Afghanistan's National Journalist Union, was killed in a clash between Taliban and NRF fighters. Well, rights organizations say they have no concrete evidence that journalists have been killed by the Taliban. However, there is little doubt that press freedom has deteriorated ever since the Taliban conquered Kabul. Of the over 10,000 people working in Afghan newsrooms in July of 2021, only 4,360 were still working in December. According to a report by RSF published at the end of last year. Now, moreover, it said that 231 media outlets out of 543 operating in the summer of 2021 disappeared during the first 3 months of the Taliban's rule. Oh, God. Well, so a survey conducted by the Afghan Journalist Union and the IJF found that 318 national media outlets have been shut down since the Taliban took over. In January, a Taliban spokesman told Deutsche Welle that the regime had not shut down any media stations in the country, yet some had stopped working after running out of funding, he said. In the same interview, he admitted that media coverage in Afghanistan had to follow rules that might be perceived as very restrictive in Western countries. In March, the Taliban blocked several international media from broadcasting in Afghanistan, including the BBC, Voice of America, and Deutsche Welle. A month later, at least a dozen journalists were arrested in Afghanistan, prompting the United Nations to call on the Taliban to stop arbitrary detention of journalists. According to the survey by the Journalist Union, lack of access to information, self-censorship, fear of reprisals, and the economic crisis were the main drivers of what the report calls an unprecedented collapse of the Afghan media, while a third of the respondents said they distrusted local and national media. Almost 9 of 10 said they trusted international media stations. Well, there was also the claim after the Taliban's takeover by spokesman Mujahid, who said, "We are assuring our countrymen and women and the international community that we will not produce any narcotics." He reminded the world that the Taliban brought production to zero back in 2000 and pledged international help to provide alternative crops. Well, the so-called fact has been unproven. Afghanistan has been by far the world's biggest producer and exporter of heroin and opium for decades. In 2020, the country provided some 85% of all non-pharmaceutical opioids worldwide, according to research by the United Nations Office on Drug and Crime. Earlier this year, the Taliban banned poppy cultivation and the harvest in early April, threatening to put farmers in prison and burn their fields. Mullah Abdul Haq Ahunt, the Deputy Interior Minister for Counter-Narcotics, told the Associated Press that the Taliban were working with other governments and non-governmental organizations to find alternative crops to provide farmers with an income. Well, so far, the Taliban seem to be sticking to this promise, and as Mujahid pointed out, they have a track record in the field. According to a 2004 World Bank study, poppy production in Afghanistan plummeted to almost zero after the Taliban cultivation ban in 2000. It only soared again after the United States toppled the regime in late 2001. However, experts question how effective and sustainable the effort to eradicate opioid production will be this time, notwithstanding that success in this endeavor could have a positive impact on foreign relations. After all, drug trafficking is a vital part of the country's economy, generating revenues between $1.8 billion and $2.7 billion in 2021. The total value of opioids made up 9% to 14% of the Afghan gross domestic product. And given other global challenges and substantial human rights issues, foreign aid could fall short of both the Taliban's expectations and the country's financial needs to cope with the economic downside of ending drug production, said South Asia analyst Shahriar Fazli. Going by the past record, curbing the opium trade could provide the Taliban's armed rivals with the same opportunity to exploit rural discontent that eradication efforts under the Republic gave the Taliban insurgency, he said. So, this is what we hear, and it's unbelievable. Now, let's look at something else that just happened. 1 second. Well, Danish Siddiqui, a Pulitzer Prize-winning photojournalist, was killed in Afghanistan. So Indian journalist Danish Siddiqui had been reporting from Kandahar, Afghanistan, when he was killed during clashes, according to a report. So Reuters photojournalist and Pulitzer Prize winner Danish Siddiqui was killed during clashes in Afghanistan, Boldak district. Tolo News reported on Friday. The Indian photojournalist was in Kandahar covering Afghanistan's internal security crisis following the withdrawal of foreign troops over the last few days. We are urgently seeking more information, working with authorities in the region, Reuters President Michael Friedenberg and Editor-in-Chief Alexander Galoni said in a statement. Danish was an outstanding journalist, a devoted husband and father, and a much-loved colleague. Our thoughts are with his family at this terrible time. So earlier on Friday, Siddiqui told Reuters he was wounded in the arm by shrapnel while reporting on a clash between Afghan security forces and Taliban fighters. He was talking to local shopkeepers when the Taliban attacked again. Siddiqui and his colleague Adnan Abidi were a part of the Reuters team that won the Pulitzer Prize for feature photography in 2018 for its reporting on the Rohingya refugee crisis. So he was praised for his coverage of the Nepal earthquake back in 2015, Mosul in 2016 to 17, and the Hong Kong pro-democracy protest in 2019 to 2020. Closer to home, Siddiqui extensively covered the 2020 Delhi riots, the farmers' protests, and the COVID-19 pandemic. So there you have it. These are the sort of things that are happening on a world stage, and it's very frightening to say the least. Now let's look at some other issues, which I hope you'll find interesting. Bear with me a moment here. Oh, goodness. Okay, for some reason,
things are a little slow today. Now, let's look at what's happening with Russia and the Ukraine. These are the updates. Aerial images suggest that a serious damage has taken place at a Crimea base. The Saki base went up in flames, with Russia claiming an ammunition depot exploding, a story ridiculed by Kyiv. Russia says Switzerland is no longer neutral and cannot represent Kyiv in Moscow. Well, commercially available satellite images taken before and after an incident that saw the Saki Air Base in Crimea rocked by explosions on Tuesday show heavy damage. In the photograph, several aircraft in the base itself appear to be severely damaged after Tuesday's blasts. Ukraine did not claim responsibility for the incident, but its Air Force said that 9 military aircraft were destroyed in an explosion. Russia claimed it was caused by an ammunition depot explosion, a statement ridiculed by Ukraine, and Russia also said no aircraft were destroyed in the blasts. Russia has said that attacks on Crimea could lead to retaliatory strikes on Ukraine, including more countries of the Ukrainian state in Kyiv. During Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's nightly video address after the blast, he vowed Ukraine would regain control of Crimea. Well, Crimea was seized in 2014 by Russian special forces in the aftermarket of an elected comparatively pro Russian government being overthrown in a popular uprising in Kyiv. They covered up their identifying badges and took control with real resistance from the international community, which reacted sharply, or acted largely, with sanctions targeting individuals and enterprises close to the Kremlin and responsible for the reoccupation and annexation of Crimea. Russia says it will not let Switzerland represent a Ukrainian interest in Russia. Ivan Nechayev, a spokesperson for Russia's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and Switzerland cannot represent Ukraine in Russia since Bern, the city of Bern in Switzerland, opted to join the EU in imposing All right, well, I think that, bear with me a moment, I think that that might be it for us today. I'm not quite sure. Let me just check some other outlets. Bear with me a moment. I want to make sure that we cover everything we need to today. Bear with me a moment here. All right. Well, it seems that dozens of homes have been destroyed and thousands have been evacuated as wildfires rage in southwestern France. So let's listen to this report. Bear with me a moment. Okay. Let me read it to you. A fire that destroyed thousands of hectares of tinder-dry forest in southwest France has flared again amid a fierce drought and the summer's latest wave of extreme heat, officials said yesterday. Black and orange skies darkened by the smoke, billowing from forests and lit up by the flames, were seen across the area as the fires continued to burn out of control, despite the efforts of firefighters backed by water bombing aircraft. So fires which have raised about 6,200 acres, or hectares rather, 5,200 acres, have almost been okay. All right. There is much more news, but evidently I'm going to need to close up right now to do some other things. So thanks for being with us today. Sorry we don't have any more time to share with you. Just have a great day. Tomorrow's Friday, and hopefully we'll be able to catch up with some more news then. So take care and be well. Goodbye.